You're listening to the Laugh Factory Podcast Network. For more shows, visit the podcast page at laughfactory.com.
It's the After Laugh, After Laugh. Welcome to the After Laugh, After Laugh, After Laugh. After Laugh, man. Go ahead, pull up a chair.
Hey guys, welcome to the After Laugh. I have an old friend with a new name.
That is true.
Now, I'd like to know the story. So, when I originally knew you, you were Katie Doll, and now you're
Kayla.
Kayla Doll.
Correct.
And it's Kayla spelled K-E-I-L-A, right?
Yeah, this man knows how to spell, everyone.
Because usually it's K-A-Y-L-A. Now, how did you become about getting your new name? How did that become? Because I imagine no one really gets a new name in their 30s unless they've had something transformation.
I had one of those transformational moments.
Yeah, for sure.
So I'll preface this by saying that I'm not like ultra religious, but I am a seeker, like
yes.
you said. And I wanted to get to know more about my Jewish heritage.
Ah.
I went on Birthright as an adult.
Wait, I thought Birthright ended, because you know I'm Jewish too.
Yes.
Right? Birthright ends at 29.
No. Well, I don't know what it is now. But
okay.
when I went a few years ago, it was cut. They had still had the cutoff at 32.
But they made an exception.
No, I was that young.
Okay, so well, a few years ago, so 5 years ago, you went and you did.
I went in 2019. It was older, adult, like age 27 to 32 on my group. Anyway, so I went on this trip and it was fun. It was flying in.
So what made you decide to go on Birthright, first of all? What was the thing that precipitated this interest in Judaism?
So my mom was born Jewish, but she converted to being Christian before she had me.
For your dad?
Just to kind of like fit in at the country club, I think.
That's hilarious. Now, did she, and this means nothing obviously, but did she look Jewish? Did she present as Jewish? Was she like, oh, I'm Jewish? Or was she like, oh, I'm going to pass as a Gentile?
I mean, by the time I was born, no.
Yeah.
She had had a nose job and the whole thing.
Okay.
But I think that as a kid and a young adult, she did, yeah.
So she never really identified with her Jewish ancestry?
No. And so it's weird growing up because my grandma, she's like making me matzo ball soup.
Yes.
And she is a New York Jew. And then my mom like was not about that. And she wasn't like a big Jesus freak or anything, but she was just like, this is what we do. We go to church because this is what all the people
do. And what was her maiden name?
Metzger.
Metzger. Okay. Yeah.
Pretty Jewish, right?
Pretty Jewish, yeah.
So then once I was old enough to have critical thinking skills,
yeah.
I thought to myself, well, I'm not really into this whole Jesus thing.
Yeah.
And I have this Jewish ancestry. It goes through the mother. And if you're into spirituality and God, but you don't believe in Jesus and you have Jewish ancestry, I guess you're Jewish.
Yeah, you're Jewish. Yeah.
So that was kind of where that seed started. And then,
yes,
yeah.
Because Judaism, as someone who has converted to Judaism,
mm-hmm.
what I found is that if you convert to Judaism and you become disillusioned with it, like you're just disillusioned with God. Because basically it's just the OG religion. The religion is just a belief in God.
Sure.
There's no real bells and whistles around hell and heaven and purgatory, none of that shit. It's just
no.
like there's a God, believe in God, worship God, live your life. And then Christianity came along and it really ended up having a lot more parameters and rules, although it was supposed to be the religion of forgiveness, but it was much more an exclusive religion. That's why I always tell people, I go, look, you know, Judaism is the only monotheistic religion of the three that hasn't murdered people to convert to Judaism. You know what I mean?
That's accurate. We're the ones getting murdered.
100%. So to me, that means, okay, whenever you look at the persecuted group, that's the group that's usually in the right. This is part of me that feels that way. Anyway, so yeah. So if Christianity doesn't appeal to you, then it's like, yeah, I don't know if I believe this whole Jesus thing. First of all, it's a huge leap of faith to believe in Jesus and the idea that Jesus is the belief in Jesus
and
is the only way to get to heaven.
And that he died for me.
Yeah, yeah.
And that I need to feel guilty about that.
Yeah. You better feel guilty about it. Yeah.
And I need to repent and that there's like original sin and all this stuff. And in Judaism, we don't believe
in
hell.
So you grew up that way, but you never really felt connected to it.
No. And it was admittedly a very casual form of Christianity. I grew up in LA.
Every third Sunday or something.
Yeah.
Holidays.
Yeah,
and
yeah. But I was going to Sunday school just because of the trips. You know, I liked going. We would go to Palm Springs, Big Bear. oh, whatever.
Right, why not?
I was like, okay, youth group, I'll go on trips.
Yeah.
But then it got a little awkward once I was about 13 or 14, like I said, and we're going around to these Bible study groups and every kid is talking about how much they love Jesus.
Yeah.
It gets to my turn and I'm like,
I've never met him.
Just happy to be here.
Yeah.
Then fast forward to, I guess, my mid, late 20s, I was dating a guy who is Israeli.
Oh, yeah.
And he was born here, but his parents were from Israel. And so he kind of held my hand and showed me more of the Jewish traditions that I was already interested in and encouraged me to go on Birthright if I wanted to. And that was when I was like, okay, let's go do this. And I can figure out, like, what is my own version of
being
involved in this? Because it's not just a religion. It's a culture. It's the food. It's the people.
Yes.
It's everything. So what is going to feel like it's my way of doing this?
Of course.
And so when I went, we had a rabbi that was traveling with us. Because when you go on Birthright, you get a... they have a tour guide and a bus driver. There was a soldier that traveled with us who's a medic.
That. Yeah.
Also, and she was maybe 18 or 19 years old, carried a machine gun at
badass.
All times.
Yeah. All these Israeli, you know, because it's mandatory to serve in the military for 2 years.
Yes.
So the women will mostly kick your ass.
Yes. And they're all stunning.
Yeah. Blue eyes, like dark eyebrows. Yeah.
Yeah. The one on our bus, she was pretty normal looking, but she was like, we were all afraid of her.
Yeah.
Anyway, the rabbi who was traveling with us, as soon as we land there, and by the way, it's all strangers. It's 40 people on the bus. Most of us don't know each other.
Yeah.
Half of my bus was Hasidic Jews. That's a whole other conversation.
Wow.
So that was fun and interesting to learn about them, because you would never have long conversations with these people in the street. Right?
Of course not. And they wouldn't talk to you. They'd be like, go away. Yeah.
No, but these, when you're forced to be together for 2 weeks,
yeah.
And then half of the bus was secular people like me.
So you're on this bus for 2 weeks traveling around Israel?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
And you stay in different places. But yeah, the rabbi at the beginning.
How big is the group that you're with?
40 people.
Oh, big. So big, like a school bus type of thing.
It's like a big tour bus type thing that's air conditioned, and you go and stay at different areas. So like we were in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Golan Heights, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah. On day one, he said, like, if anybody who was not bar about mitzvah as a child and you're interested in doing that on this trip, let me know. And so I thought, well, fuck it. Let's do it.
Yeah.
Right? What's it going to hurt?
So they gave you a mikvah?
No mikvah. Because of my lineage, according to this rabbi and pretty much every other rabbi I've talked to, I don't have to convert.
Yeah.
So,
well, you can still take a mikvah without converting, but anyway, as a ritual, but that's fine.
Right.
So,
no, I'm saying that wasn't part of it. It was mostly just like, okay, study, do the thing.
So the bat mitzvah, you had to read the Haftorah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We did a little quickie version of that. And like each person, it was me and a few other people. It was like me and four other people that also had not had this as a kid, and we hiked to the top of Mount Masada at sunrise, and there were a bunch of ruins on the top.
Wow.
And then we went down into this cave. It was very biblical, very weird.
Yeah.
Very fun.
I've never been. I've wanted to go so bad.
Yeah.
I'm going to go at some point. It's bucket list for sure.
It's fun.
So where was the moment on this trip where things just congealed in your head, or kind of like
there.
Okay, good. Yeah, I know. Foreplay, I love it.
No, it's okay. Foreplay?
You mean, so, go slow. Tell me more.
I'm dead. Sorry. So we go into this cave. We do the bar mitzvah. We dance around. It's cute. It's fun. Whatever.
How many people got bar mitzvah and bat mitzvah in that group?
It was me and four other people.
Okay. Yeah.
So it was kind of fun to do it that way, and it was casual. I didn't have to worry about thinking of a bar mitzvah theme.
Yeah. It was much better that way.
Getting dressed up or anything.
So Evites. Yeah.
No. Yeah. We get out of there, and there is a rabbi that is handwriting the Torah, like in calligraphy.
Oh, I love that.
So if you go to a temple, you know how they have the fancy Torah at the front with the jewels and
with
stuff?
You scroll down. It's worth, like, it's priceless. If you drop it, like, everyone goes to hell. Yeah.
This is the guy who does those.
Oh, wow.
And so he's just like sitting in a little room behind some glass, writing it out. And the people who are the leaders of the trip, they know that I'm like very outgoing and will go talk to anybody. They go, you should go tell him that you got bat mitzvah and he'll be happy for you. I was like, all right, fine. So I go over there in my broken Hebrew, which don't ask me to repeat it because I forgot all of it.
Oh, Hebrew's tough. It's like next to Mandarin. It's the hardest language in the world.
It's very tough. But I went over and told him that I got bat mitzvah. He asked me what my Hebrew name was, which I chose, Kayla. Mm-hmm. And he wrote it out on a piece of paper for me.
Oh.
He handed it to me. And in that moment, I looked at that piece of paper And I was at this holy site, and it was one of those things like in a movie where the heavens open and there's just the light that comes down and you're like, oh.
Yeah.
And I just was like, wow, I need that on my body. I have a tattooed on my foot.
Yeah.
Like right after I got back, I was like, I need to do that.
Oh, and I want
to
see it.
Yeah. Well, that's the crazy part. It's the same foot that I just had surgery on a few months ago.
Oh, okay. Anyway, nice. Yeah.
But yeah, that's there. So when I came home, I was like, this is who I am. I want to change my name. And everyone in my life was like,
why?
We get that you're really excited about being Jewish, but like, you need to chill.
Yeah. And a month you might change your mind. Yeah.
And so a few years later, I ended up saying fuck it and doing it. But the meaning behind the name specifically, I never liked the name Katie. It's great for other people.
Yeah.
But it just never felt like it fit me. But I never had a great alternative.
Yeah.
And so I was just like, whatever, at least I have a cute last name and fine. And then when this trip came up and they asked me to pick a Hebrew name, I picked the name Kayla, not thinking I was going to use it as my name.
What does it mean in Hebrew?
So there are a few different meanings. The meaning that like resonated the most with me was the idea of being a vessel. So one meaning in Hebrew is the word vessel, which I take to mean for me, like if I'm at my best personally, creatively, anything like that, then I'm a vessel for love
and inspiration. And
it's flowing through me. Yeah. I'm not trying to control things or manufacture anything. And so, yeah, when I picked that name and then also went through this whole ceremony, and then that rabbi handed me this gorgeous cursive Hebrew of that name, I was like, wow, well, this is who I want to be. This is how I want to walk through life.
Yeah.
Is like being of service and really channeling the best possible things that I can.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's kind of how it all came about. And I think the actual like doing of the changing, which was in 2021, there's a whole other story about this. So
in terms of change your name legally or?
No, like even doing it. Cause it was something I thought about and people told me to chill. Right.
Yeah. And why then, didn't want people, why, what were the reasons for you not to change your name? Were they just
it
like,
would be crazy.
You gotta change all your forms. You gotta do, but people get divorced. They have to change their forms all the time too.
Right. But it's like, people change their last names all the time.
All the time.
When they get married or divorced.
All the time.
Why is it such a big deal with the first name? I don't know. Just
interesting.
Is.
Interesting, yeah.
And so speaking of getting married or divorced, I was engaged. I called off the engagement in 2021.
With the Israeli guy?
No. Different person.
Different guy.
And so
how long were you engaged before you called it off?
6 months.
Wait, was he Jewish?
No.
Was that a problem?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, that wasn't like the problem, but,
yeah, but it was
a
one of the problems.
Problem.
Sure. And he had no interest in converting or
no.
Yeah.
No, he was making Holocaust jokes every other day. So it was definitely not a good match.
Yeah.
But
although I'm like, the comic to me is like, any good ones?
So when I called that off, I remember that was one of the hardest decisions I ever made in my life was to like up. Like,
how long have you been dating him?
We were friends, platonic, close friends for 20 years.
Oh, wow.
Then we dated during COVID, you know, one of those things.
That'll do it.
And yeah, I guess in total, we were together for about a year and a half.
Year and a half.
2 years. But like,
and then you called off. What was the main reason why you called off the engagement? Had wedding invites been sent out at this point?
Save the dates. Not invites.
Okay. So just before that.
Yeah. I mean, it was...
parents were all excited for it. And
yes.
The families, you got along with the parents and they go vice versa.
Yes.
So everything, all the outside forces were saying yes.
Yeah.
But something inside you was like, let's pump the brakes.
Yeah.
So what was the main reason why you decided to call it off?
Well, let's see. Let's just say...
He won't listen to it.
Oh, I know. It's just one of those things that's like not fun to talk about. You know what I mean?
I understand.
But basically, it was like once the ring went on my finger, it was Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Interesting.
And there was a side of this person that I had known almost my entire life that I'd never seen. And he's gotten a lot of help and hopefully
is
he's treating women better now.
Is it regarding
now.
Jealousy?
Or? No, it was like emotional abuse and verbal abuse.
Control
and all kinds of really dark
stuff
shit.
Like that. Yeah, okay.
That, you know, It is
you
what it
never
is.
Saw it coming. Nothing. No. There's not even any, like, he got cut off in traffic. Like, well, that's an interesting.
Sure. I mean, everybody has the capacity to be angry. Yeah.
But sometimes when people say, and by the way, I can relate because I had, you know, I started dating someone during COVID and it was just like, you know, everything was, and then there was a point where I saw a turn, which doesn't make her a bad person. But for me, it was so unsettling that that was a facet of her personality, which I didn't know that I never was able to get my footing back after I saw that.
Yeah, it was a similar situation.
You know, I guess the equivalent would be for a man, because I know a lot of women have been with this with guys. They're with a guy, he's nice, he's cool, he's sweet, and then he gets drunk at a bar and he punches someone in the face. Mm. And they're like, what the fuck is that? Mm-hmm. You're that guy? Yeah. Like, no, baby, I was drunk. And you're like, okay, but still, in the back of mind, you're like,
you're
I think
capable
he's that
of
guy.
That.
He's that guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like that. It was hard to kind of ever, and every time it kind of came up again, then it just became a thing where I just, it overwhelmed everything else about her personality because it was so, I was like lying in wait for it to happen again. You know what I mean? Anyway, so.
It's kind of like that.
Yeah.
Okay. I would say. And I think a lot of independent, strong women can relate to this where a dude will meet you. And they'll be like, I love all this strong stuff about you. And then they get you and they want to make you small.
You know? Yeah.
So. Anyway.
I think that might be true from both sides coming either direction. Sorry. Is people, because at the end of the day, the one thing that people don't have, no matter what type of money or job you have, you don't have control over another person's agency.
No.
You just don't. But I do think it is something that people have a weird primordial urge for. I mean, this is a bad example.
Can't wait.
But like Louis C.K., I know, not the best person to bring up, talk about abusive people, but like he has this bit where he talks about how all these Gen Z people are like, I would never own slaves. You guys are such dicks for owning slaves. He goes, if you look at like ancient writings and hieroglyphs, like it was like the third thing that we did.
Right.
And that has nothing to do with race. Like wherever we were, we just like, as like the wheel of fire, now let's make someone else do it. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of people having agency over other people is obviously something that exists, and it's not the best part of man or woman, but it exists over people.
It's in human nature. Yeah. There's a thing where like we want to control, but I think that need for control is not just based on like laziness of like, oh, let's get someone else to do this. But when you're in a romantic relationship, it comes out of insecurity.
100%. 100%.
And that's because.
Do you know what his insecurity was about? I mean, were you able to kind of like figure out why? Why? Like, what about his childhood or his upbringing made him feel the need to act out his insecurity that way?
I mean, I think that it takes two to tango, right?
For sure.
I can't just sit here and pretend that this is a villain and I've done
You're so
nothing.
Mature. Look at you.
No, really. I've done a lot of therapy. I host a mental health podcast.
Yes.
If I'm not going to walk the walk,
of course.
Like I shouldn't be hosting it, which is something I realized after I started it. I was like, oh, fuck. I got to clean up my act.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Because
yeah.
I really just wanted to start it so I could talk out loud about panic attacks and anxiety and feel okay about it.
When did you have your first panic attack?
My first one that I knew was happening. It was actually what?
A little closer.
Hello?
Just a little bit closer.
A little bit closer.
Just a teeny
bit. The mic right here. Okay.
No, you have
so
to be that
intimate.
Close. You have to be that close.
My first panic attack that I had that I recognized as such was right before I graduated NYU. So I was 20.
And you went there for undergrad for acting, yeah?
Mm-hmm. For theater.
We talked about you were in the experimental wing, were you?
Oh,
or
I
Stella
wish.
Adler?
No, I was at Stella Adler.
Stella, okay, got it.
Yes, experimentally theater wing. It was like they just like get naked and throw paint all over the stage.
They work in black box theaters the rest of their lives. It's great. Yeah,
it's fun. But yeah, I remember that was a kind of a crazy moment.
So when you were graduating, was the panic attack, if you could pinpoint where it came from, it was just like, what is the world going to be? What do I do with this fucking useless degree? Or what was it?
It kind of. I mean, I'm type A, overachiever, always doing something.
Yeah.
And at that point, it was like, okay, I had been an AP student. I got into my dream school.
Yeah.
I graduated a full year early because I had worked so hard.
From NYU?
Yes.
For acting school? You graduate early from acting school? I didn't know you could do that.
Did it.
Yeah, okay.
I did it.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's because I could have done 4 years, but I had extra academic credits and everything from high school, so.
Got it.
I did one little summer abroad in Florence and
Yeah.
That gave me my extra credits and I could graduate. If I had stayed an extra year, then I could have, like, I thought I was going to double major in psychology or English, but once I heard that I could leave a year early and save my parents 50 grand, I was like,
Of course, okay.
Let's just do this, you know.
Now, I don't know much about NYU undergrad. Yes. I mean, obviously, Tisch is one of the best schools for the arts in the country. Which I don't know what the fuck that means, but it is. But I know that for grad school, when you graduate, at least it used to be the case, you were almost kind of, because of the leagues, you were kind of given an agent in a weird way.
Oh,
not everyone got an agent, but you would do you do joint leagues with Yale. So they're like the top two next under Juilliard.
Yes.
And then you would, all the agents and all the managers would come from New York, and
yeah,
you would
pretty much get thing. One.
But in the undergrad, I know that's not really the case. So I don't know what do they do to help you transition to the world?
They do similar stuff.
Oh, they do?
Yeah. Like, I remember Adler had a program called Adler in LA. I didn't feel the need to do it because I was from here and I had already
But it was after you graduated, they would have these programs.
They had them. I think people did them either between junior and senior year or around their senior year, sometimes after. And then they would have a lot of showcases in New York that they would invite managers and agents to that were hosted by the various studios. So similar situation.
Okay,
I think.
So you graduated a year early.
Yes.
Now you're with you're graduating with people you didn't even know, probably, right?
The kids that there were a few kids that I knew that graduated early like me, but most of them graduated the next year. Yeah.
Okay. And you're in New York. You're in a little shoebox of an apartment, I'm guessing.
Yeah, East Houston and Allen, first and first.
By the way, now that's a great area.
Oh, my God.
You would kill to have that fucking address now.
I mean, it was pretty cute and coming up when I was staying there, too.
Okay.
I mean, there was a yoga studio around the corner. I feel like that's the mark
of
gentrification.
But now there's a Whole Foods right there.
But it was on the same block as Katz's Deli.
Yeah, or like exactly 2 blocks away. I know exactly where it is.
Yeah, so I remember I was looking down the barrel of a gun almost of, okay, I just spent all this time and energy building this whole life in New York, making all these amazing friends, and I've been achieving. Now I'm going to be going back to LA to go back to work because I had already been working in commercials and TV as an actor in high school here.
So you're going to move to LA to be back as a commercial actor?
Yeah, or just see where it goes because I feel like, okay,
You had an agent and all that stuff?
I had one, yeah, and I thought, like, okay, easy to pick it back up.
Yeah, for sure.
Fine.
Why not?
And I don't sing and dance that much, and that was the main thing that people were staying in New York for, was to be in musicals, so I thought, let's just go to LA.
100%.
But I think all of the unknown was really what was just, it spiraled me, you know?
Yeah.
Plus a lot of other stuff, like I had just gotten my first love, my first real boyfriend, we had broken up that January, just like, you know, things.
Of course, complete uncertainty.
Yeah.
And your parents, your parents were in the business or no?
No.
No.
No, my mom is a financial planner. Stepdad is a real estate lawyer. They're both retired now.
And were they supportive of your journey into acting?
I mean, they sent me to school for it because they saw
this will be a phase.
Exactly. I think that they agreed to send me to school for it after I started making money doing commercials in high school. They were like, okay.
That makes sense.
This is viable.
Yeah.
But as soon as I graduated, they were like, so you're going to take over your mom's finance firm, right? Like, you're just going to go do that now? And I thought,
Succession? No.
What part of my entire upbringing led you to believe that I would ever be good enough at math? Or even interested in that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's not my thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're good now. But there was definitely...
So how did the panic attack manifest itself? Like, where were you? How did it happen? Like, what did it look like? Were you in... Because whenever I hear about panic attack, particularly in New York, I picture someone in a subway.
Oh.
Because I know a lot of people... There's a girl in my class who would get panic attacks, and she would talk about it, and she would have it in the subway.
Oh, interesting.
And I feel like, for me, I've never had an actual panic attack where I felt like I was going to die, really.
Yeah.
But other than, like, if I'm doing jiu-jitsu and someone heavy is on top of me and I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to die. That's different.
Because you might actually die.
You might actually
if that guy suffocates you with his, like, 300 pounds
or
whatever.
But I've been on subway platforms and just the anxiety and the heat and the stress and all that. Like, I understand, like, right before it.
Like walking through a crowd of people or something. Yeah, I understand that.
So where were you when this happened?
No, I was alone. At home. I was in my little apartment, but I think you could still, because we were only on the second floor, you could see and hear all the noise outside. It's a very
Oh, yeah.
Busy intersection, all of that. I think it was nighttime. I had only tried weed a month or two before that.
Oh, you were smoking weed.
It's a little fuzzy. I'll admit that. There's a little bit of weed. There's a little bit of wine, that kind of thing. No, like drugs. Other than that.
And you just graduated.
No, I was this was in March.
So you're about to graduate.
I was going
to
graduate in May. But yeah, I'd been having a rough time, and my gay best friend who I lived with at the time, we were kind of doing a Will and Grace situation.
Those are the best.
Yeah, he was a total stoner, and I had been very straight edge up until I went through this breakup, and he's like, honey, you gotta just have a little weed, cry with me, you're gonna feel better. And this wasn't the first time I tried weed, but I remember the few times I tried it during that period of time. I don't know if it was the wrong strain or if it was laced with something else or what, but it would make me very anxious and weird and paranoid, you know? So, I just remember pacing around my apartment, having all these like racing thoughts going through my mind, hyperventilating, my heart is racing. And I felt like I couldn't breathe. My vision was closing in and I literally thought I was having a heart attack.
Oh yeah.
I thought I was going to die.
Yeah.
And that's just because I didn't know what was happening.
Yeah.
And now I understand it. But I remember calling my friend Nikki, and she went with me to the ER, and they checked me out, and they're like, you're going to be fine, kid.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You got a thing called anxiety. Here's some...
And did you know what a panic attack was at the time? Like, had you been familiar and acquainted? Did you know? Was the part of you was like, oh, I'm having a panic attack. No. You're just like, I'm going to die.
I mean, I was educated, so I knew that panic attacks existed.
Yeah.
I just, especially in that moment, I didn't think that that's what was happening to me.
Yeah.
And I didn't think of myself as a person with anxiety, even though I very much was.
Yeah, interesting.
Because my brother, I think the reason I thought I was so normal, is that my brother has autism. And so growing up, I was the normal one.
Yeah,
she's fine. Everything's fine.
Yeah, of course. And so, yeah, they wouldn't focus on you.
No.
Yeah.
And I wasn't focusing on myself either.
Sure.
So, yeah, that ended up being a really good thing. And not that that happened, but me learning about that and getting help and learning how to manage it.
I mean, so how many panic attacks have you had since then?
I mean, I don't know if I could count.
Oh, is that
it's
many?
Not like it just...
Is it like... Because I guess my question... Because I think about that and I look at my life. I go, okay, there was a time I was doing edibles for the first time.
Uh-huh.
I think people probably have a lot of panic attacks on edibles.
It could.
But I remember...
Now I stick to indica, by the way, if anybody is an anxious person. Don't touch the sativa. Indica only.
I agree. So, and I remember one point I was... When I was early in my weed years, which was probably only about 7 years ago when I started smoking weed, really.
Oh, really?
7 or 8. And then... When it became legal, because I'm a good Christian soldier. So I felt like at one point my left arm went numb, was going numb.
Okay.
Smoking weed. And I remember, and I was with a girl, and I remember thinking, huh, left arm, oh, that's where your arm goes numb when you have a heart attack. So then all of a sudden I'm just like in bed like, oh, fuck, I'm having a heart attack. And I was Googling, literally I was up, walk around Googling heart attack symptoms for like hours. And then I'm like, okay, if this is it's the slowest onset heart attack of all time, if it's taking 3 hours to fucking kick in.
Right.
I mean, who knows? Maybe there was some sort of, atrium closure going on that I wasn't familiar with and I just didn't like.
Did you tell her what was going on?
Yeah, I think she was kind of like, this guy's fucking freaking out.
Yeah.
I didn't go to the hospital, but I was definitely, and keep in mind, I'd also been a yogi and a yoga teacher for a while, so
yeah,
I was employing all my techniques about breathing and relaxing and lowering my heart rate and everything. Mm-hmm. But I just remember the idea of the numb arm. I was like, oh, that's it.
Yeah.
I'm fucking dying.
I'm done.
Yeah.
Put a fork in me, done.
So what prophylactic tools do you have to combat it? Like in terms of you feel it coming on, you must have a protocol to get through it.
Well, it's twofold. One is prevention, which is just setting up your life in such a way that you are less likely to be set off.
Mm-hmm.
Because often if you have your first panic attack, that means that there's a lot of shit in your life that is overwhelming, too stressful. Mm-hmm. Maybe there's people that you shouldn't be associating with, or maybe your job or whatever. Usually there's some sort of change that you need to make in your life. I mean, yes, it's a disorder, like panic disorder, but a perfectly quote-unquote normal person might have a panic attack or two within their lifetime if their lifestyle is unsustainable, really. Yeah. And I feel like that's what people aren't always looking at, because it's not just drugs. Like, you might want to just look at the whole of your life and see, okay, what is helping me, what's not helping me, and really look at that. But outside of that, if I feel something coming, like an episode or something coming on, then it's usually catching it as quickly as possible and taking time out of whatever I'm doing and breathing, like you're saying, like the yoga breathing. I have Valium that I take as needed, which ends up being maybe once a week or once every other week at this point.
Okay. So, because because panic attack, the idea of panic attack is fascinating to me. So I'm wondering, when you feel it coming on,
yes,
because I guess in my head, part of me is like, it's probably has something to do with the fact that all these stressors are kind of accruing in your mind and in your life. And if you don't deal with them one by one or as they come on, they kind of build to this sort of overwhelming force.
Yeah.
And then just like, blah.
It can happen.
But I don't know. But I also don't know anything about it, really. So I guess my question for you is, when you feel, I know you said fix your life accordingly, but obviously life is life and life will fuck you up.
You can't like insulate yourself from everything.
So what happened? Give me an example of like the last time you felt it was potentially coming on and you were like, okay, I'm going to cut this off at the pass. I'm going to circumvent it. And what were the cues to let you know that it was time to take a Valium or do whatever protocol is to stop it?
Yeah. Well,
I mean, how sudden do they come on?
Right. Well, those are a lot of questions. Let's start from the beginning. So like the last time I had like what we'll call like an episode, right, was actually last week in New York. And I remember I went to a Broadway show with a few friends.
What show?
I went to see Grey House.
Great. I don't know.
It's great.
Who's
in
it?
It's so good. Tatiana Maslany from She-Hulk. Uh-huh. And she was a star of Orphan Black. And Laurie Metcalf is in it. And it's a spooky straight play.
Interesting.
It's like a cabin in the woods thriller on stage.
Interesting.
And they have like a whole group of girls in nightgowns that are super creepy. And like, even though it's not a musical, they sing little creepy songs together and people are popping out of different places. Or
wow, that does not seem like the no-brainer for Broadway. Was it like the Helen Hayes Theater? Was it in like the small theater?
No, it was in the Lyceum.
Okay.
It's pretty big.
Wasn't that where the Phantom was?
Well, that would be appropriate.
Anyway, so yeah, there you go.
But anyway, I went to see that, which is great. And that's not, I don't think, what affected me to... That would be crazy if I'm in the middle of the theater. I got so scared. I have a... But I remember we left and I was supposed to get happy hour with my friends and both of them bailed. And I was just like, ugh, that sucks.
Yeah.
You know? And...
Oh, no. Hold on.
What's wrong? Were we not recording?
No, we are. We're all good. We're good. Okay. The battery's low, but it's fine. We're good.
All right. Well, let me know if you need me to change anything or if you want.
No, you're perfect. All right. Okay. Keep on. So you were at happy hour. Your friends didn't want to go.
Didn't want to go. So then me and my boyfriend are walking down like through Times Square. There's too many people. It's exactly what you're talking about, where it's just overwhelming, right?
Yeah.
And then because we had gone for my birthday, he was kind of being like, hey, let's do whatever you want to do all week, right? And so then because that plan was out, we're walking down. He's like, well, what are we going to do next? And so I'm hearing that in my ear with all these people. And like the other plans fell through, which maybe triggered a little bit of an abandonment issue from my childhood. Subconsciously, maybe.
Yeah.
And I think that it just kind of bubbled over because I remember I felt it coming and I was like, hey, I can't talk right now.
Yeah.
And then I was like, I have to sit down, and literally just like found a little stoop to sit down on. And like,
so you got out of Times Square, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
You walked down like a side
street.
Yeah.
Down. Yeah. And just like let myself like breathe and cry a little bit. And then he's really good with it, so he was just like, hey, let's go to a cafe across the street and just like sit for a while and mm-hmm. can I get you some water or whatever. And just I think breathing through it, acknowledging your feelings instead of fighting them. Because I think that's the other thing about anxiety that maybe people don't understand is I see it as friction. It's friction between like how you would rather feel versus how you currently feel.
Sure.
And you're trying to bottle up these feelings and emotions and you can't. It's going to come out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or like you're trying to control a situation. It's not going the right way. It's like you got to let go.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, I guess that's the best way I could explain
it. Do you have a mantra that you tell yourself when you're going through it?
Yeah. I think just like, hey, this is temporary. This is just right now. I'm not going to die.
Yeah.
And like it's mostly the like, this is just right now.
Yeah.
And also the grounding techniques. That's something that's really good is to bring you into the present moment instead of spiraling into future scenarios or obsessing.
So grounding is like what, touching physical things near you?
All five senses. Okay. So you can think about just touching your jeans and noticing, like really noticing the texture, which I know sounds very granola and crunchy, but just really noticing and then going to glass and like, oh, that's a different texture and just that. What are you smelling? Mm-hmm. What are you hearing in the space that's close to you? What are you hearing that's far away from you? Or even just in your head, naming off three objects in the room.
Interesting, yeah.
And it's just, it gets your mind off it.
Yeah.
Because your brain can't obsess over whatever it's anxious about and think of three things in the room at the same time.
I love that.
It can't.
So it's like part of your brain is tricking another part of your brain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And there's something else that I learned that's outside of this, with the five senses. I think that's the easiest one because it's very easy to remember in the moment, is doing this four square thing. I remember the few times that I've had to deal with this in public that's like I'm at a job or something,
right?
And you can't step away, right?
Yeah.
You can do this and no one knows that you're doing it, is you just do your deep breathing and then pretend there's a box, right?
Mm-hmm.
So top left corner, you're looking at it. And from the top left corner to the right left corner, you're inhaling. And you move your eyes, right? And then you exhale as you go from the top right to the bottom right. And then you inhale across the square and exhale up. And you keep doing that.
I like that.
And it's, yeah. It's another way to trick your brain, because the other thing that I've learned, which, have you ever heard of EMDR therapy?
No.
It's eye movement.
Dialectic or whatever it was called.
Yeah, I forget what it stands for, but it's
rapid
eye movement. And what they do is they have you think about a traumatic memory and then they have you move your eyes back and forth, left and right. And it's the same kind of thing where you're fucking with your brain of like stimulating both the left and right part at the same time.
Interesting.
And it kind of rewires it.
Okay, so it puts an emotional part into the logical place and the logical part in the emotional place or something like
it just changes it, because I mean there's electricity in there and it's all these, you know, you can rewire it.
Yeah, that's great. So what made you your mental health podcast, you've been for how long ago now?
I started it in 2020, so we've been going for 3 years. It's called Crying Behind Sunglasses.
So what was the thing that made you do that? What was the, did you have the eureka moment where you're like, I got to do this podcast?
Kinda. So I had only done on camera stuff for most of my life in theater. I'd never done radio or podcast or voiceover.
Voiceover, really? Interesting. You have your voice. Okay.
Thank you. But you know, I mean, no one ever told me I had a face for radio, so.
Touché.
Did not cross my mind.
Yes, I get
and,
that.
And I was working with this guy, Ray William Johnson, as his producer and assistant, and he and this other guy, Epic Lloyd, who does Epic Rap Battles on YouTube.
Sure.
So they're both huge YouTubers and they co-hosted like a fun pal around podcast and they put me on as their third mic.
Nice.
Kind of like the Robin to their Howard Stern.
Yes,
like,
yes.
Hey, okay, boys, like let's respect women. And so I did that and I thought, wow, this is really fun.
Yeah.
Like we were live streaming to YouTube. I'm talking to the fans every week. And
how many viewers do they have? I mean, I know their Epic Rap Battles were legendary.
I mean, they had a lot of subscribers. I want to say, I mean, I'll throw a number out there and it's probably wrong, but I think we had at least 16K subscribers on YouTube, something like that. Yeah. But they each had like over a million, you know, so I feel like it's hard to measure when you're publishing a podcast on a lot of platforms. Like,
yeah, exactly.
But anyway, so I was doing that, and then they decided to end that pod at the end of 2019. And I had caught the bug. I was like, this is fun.
Yeah.
You know? And so I thought, if I want to host my own podcast, what would it be? I have to figure out a topic that I can talk about with people that I'm not going to get bored with, and that is not going to just be like adding to the noise.
Sure.
And so I made a whole list of things that I was interested in that are not filmmaking or acting, because listen, we have enough.
Yeah.
A24 already has a podcast. Like,
yeah.
So on that list was therapy, dogs, wine, travel.
Therapy, dogs, wine. That's 90% of the women in LA. That's what they do a podcast about. Therapy, dogs, or wine.
Or all
or
the
true
above.
Crime, yes.
Oh, true crime, yeah. I love Last Podcast on the Left. I think that's my favorite.
Yeah.
You listen to that one?
No.
Oh, okay. Anyway, so I then listened to podcasts in all those different categories, and I thought, well, this mental health is something that I'm passionate about. It can help people. I really, like, I'm a do-gooder. Both of the film projects I've made, I've donated a lot of money to charity. So I thought, this is something I can help people, and I'm passionate about it. And when I was listening to them, I thought, I could do something different, because even the mental health podcasts that are hosted by comedians, I'm not going to name names, but they're not funny. No. And you come away feeling like you took on trauma.
Wow, interesting.
Or at least for me.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, well, why did I listen to that? Now I just feel like...
Feel worse.
And so I thought, okay, well, this is something I can do. This is, I can talk to comedians or experts about their issues, and we can leave room for dark jokes. We can laugh about it, or we can, I can ask people, how did you get out of that? Kind of similar to what you were asking me about how I manage my anxiety. And yeah, it's just been really healing. I also started a Facebook support group of the same name, Crying Behind Sunglasses, that has, you know, people in there all talking about their feelings and helping each other. So it's been really fulfilling.
So you started this in 2019. So it's kind of like in
2020.
Okay, yeah. 2020, before the pandemic started.
I had the
started.
Idea, like basically New Year's Eve 2019, when I was like, what am I going to do next year? This was
thing. It sounds awful to say, and I don't mean it in a Machiavellian way, but like, what great timing.
I know.
Right when mental health became first and foremost, like, you know.
All of a sudden, everyone's locked in their homes and depressed, and everyone's dying.
Yeah.
And even people who aren't normally depressed were having a problem.
Absolutely. I think if everyone does a true inventory of themselves in that time, I think you're either, the only equivalent I can think of was living in Manhattan during 9/11.
Oh.
It was one of those things where you couldn't really spend your days thinking about or address when you were living right near it. You know, you had to kind of, whistle past a graveyard, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I feel like that's what I did during COVID. I was just like, nothing to see here. It's all fucking bullshit. I wasn't like, it's fake. It ain't real disease. But I was also a little bit like, man, I'm being indoctrinated on every level by different people and into fear.
Indoctrinated? What do you mean?
Just either being indoctrinated by people who think that everything is a conspiracy, that's a lie, or being indoctrinated into the idea that, you're going to die and you're an irresponsible person if you don't follow the rules to a T. I didn't believe any of those.
Right.
I was kind of someone who, I've always been really good at keeping terms with my own health and keeping tabs on my own health and knowing like what I'm okay with, what I'm not okay with. So I personally, and now it feels a little justified. I mean, I took the vaccine because I wanted to get on
board. I was about to ask. I was like, oh God, about to find out that Bill is an anti-vaxxer.
No, I wanted to get but I will tell you this. I wanted to get on the vaccine. No, because I wanted to work.
Yeah.
I didn't want to go on the vaccine because I felt I needed to, because I'd had COVID.
Oh,
I got Delta. I got the vaccine late. I got Delta. And after I got Delta, I was like, man, I don't want to fucking get the vaccine because the idea that people wholesale bought the line from Fauci and Big Pharma just strike me as a little weird for like a liberal mind to do. Because like, aren't we the skeptical ones? When does skepticism become a sin? Because it struck me as very odd that whenever a doctor, and there were a lot of accredited doctors who were just sort of like, okay, look, the vaccine's good. Like obviously my parents and obviously people, but for my health, I just said, I don't think I need it. I got it anyway, But there is a part of me that's like, oh, I wish I didn't get it. And I said that to a director, a film director.
You're the worst.
I mean, look, the facts are out now, and the facts cater to what I'm saying.
I say that with love. No, yeah. It's just funny because to me, I'm like, I wasn't prepared for an anti-vax debate, so I won't get totally into it.
It's
today,
not anti-vax. But,
no,
by the
I know,
way.
I know.
It's saying that the vaccine is not for everybody.
Sure.
If you're 24 years old and perfect, like Kyrie Irving didn't need to get the fucking vaccine. He should not have been banned, or Djokovic. He should have been banned from tennis or NBA because you didn't get the vaccine. These are people at prime physical condition.
I guess so. I don't know. I mean, for me, I got it as soon as it was available, and I got a booster. I'm glad that I got it. I got the vaccine in like spring of 2021.
Okay.
And then I ended up getting Delta around September-ish. But like, I was glad that I had the vaccine before that because it would have been a lot worse. Like infection,
yeah.
You know?
Perhaps, yeah.
And
it's an unfalsifiable claim too. You know what I mean? You don't know. But it could have been.
Yeah. And I just feel like if there's something I can do to protect myself.
Yeah.
It's like the only pandemic that most of us have ever lived through, I think.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So whatever I can do, great. I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And anyway, that's all I have to say about that. But
let me ask you a question.
Yes.
If someone you knew was 30.
Yeah.
And they were playing tennis. This happened. They were 34 playing tennis.
Is it a friend of yours?
It's a friend of a friend.
Oh, got it.
She was engaged to a man. They were playing tennis. And he literally had a heart attack and dropped dead right then.
So sad.
My first thought was, when did you get your last vaccination? Now, that might be paranoid. That might be fucking like the right-wing media getting to me.
But people also died from heart attacks after contracting COVID in general.
Look, I don't know. This is one thing I'll say.
People have heart attacks all the time for no reason.
This is one thing I'll say about COVID.
Yeah.
It's out of, except for like 3% or 2% of the population, it's outside of everyone's fucking purview.
Yeah.
So we don't know.
Yeah, we're just two comedians trying to pretend that we know anything.
Well, that was everybody during the pandemic, right? Well, here's COVID. The idea that I had people who wouldn't book me on shows because I wasn't vaccinated yet.
Oh.
And I was like, that's ridiculous. I test myself. I'm negative. Well,
if you're willing to test,
variant.
No, that's not fair. I think the testing, like if you're saying I'm not vaccinated, but hey, I'm going to show you my test result.
Yeah.
You're being very honest. You're respecting their boundaries. Fine.
But you still can't work in SAG doing that.
No, I understand. But I'm saying in that case that you're talking about, as a showrunner, if someone was willing to show me their negative test result.
Yeah.
Great. Fine.
Yeah.
Come play.
It's crazy how angry people got on both sides to either. I was never, I think if you want to get vaccinated, that's fine. But at the same time, I also, and I did get it. But at the same time, I also said, haven't I spent my entire life learning that getting the disease vaccinates you? Like why is natural immunity being looked at as like you wear a QAnon fucking t-shirt? Anyway, moving on from that, because clearly this is nothing you want to talk about.
Well, that's okay. I mean, you know, I just feel like there's other things that have happened since then that are more exciting.
Yeah, like what?
getting to see you for the first time in like several years.
Oh my god, what was the last time? Was it filming that movie Before the Sun Explodes? Was that the last time
we talked? Was really fun.
Did we have a fight? I forget.
I don't know, but Molly Merkel, I remember I met that day on set.
Yeah, there's some great people.
Aaron Darling.
Aaron was there. Yeah, there's some great people connected. The film didn't
quite work. I don't think you and I got into a fight. We didn't get into a fight.
We just kind of fell out of touch. It happens in LA. It happens in LA a lot where you just kind of like the people, hey, they're cool. And then all of a sudden, like a week, 2 weeks, and a month, and then it's years.
Right.
How the fuck has it been like? So it's probably been like 6 years since I've seen you last.
Right. But then if you take the pandemic off, right? So then maybe only three.
Yeah. And so now the next thing I want to ask you about
is your
stand up. You started doing stand-up.
Oh my God, I'm a baby stand-up. I'm an infant.
That's great.
Yes.
That's all great. So what made you decide, because obviously you have these moments in your life where you go, okay, inspiration, I'm now going to be into my Jewish roots, I'm going to start a podcast. Now, like, what was the thing that inspired you to get into stand-up? Because I always think stand-up is, everyone has a different story to get into stand-up.
Of course.
And it's very rare that people are like, I was 14. It's all I wanted to do.
No.
It's usually a much more circumlocuous route to get to it. So what made you decide in your 30s to go like, hey, This is what I want to try this.
Sure. Well, like a lot of other actresses, you know, things, the career goes up and down.
Yeah.
And this is like, oh, a consistent way that I can perform by myself. Mm-hmm. And not have to get a team of people together, because I come from, I did theater from age 9 through forever.
Yeah.
And then after college, got into comedy via improv. Like I did UCB. I did the whole program there.
How many years is that, the UCB program? Is that like 7 years or something? What is that?
You can do it as quickly or as slowly as you want. At the time, it was 101, 201, like 1 through 4.
Yeah.
Like levels 1 through 4. And then you go to advanced if they think you're good.
Yeah.
And then after that, you know, however long you want to do it.
You get part of the house team or whatever the fuck
sure,
it is.
Sure, sure, yeah. Sure. So I was also at the PAC Theater. I was on a house sketch team there. And I had a lot of indie improv teams. And I'm trying to think what else. Played a lot of festivals. I hosted a variety show called The Scramble for four years, which was really fun.
Where was that?
It was also at the PAC.
Okay.
We started it at a warehouse, and then the warehouse shut down.
So the variety show was like singing, sketch, stand-up, everything?
It was a true variety show. It was called The Scramble. It was on Sunday afternoons. We would serve mimosas and donuts.
I love it.
And we had stand-up, improv, sketch. We would always try to have some sort of music element. So we had a few different local bands we would work with.
Yeah.
That would play on the shows, or we would have burlesque. We even had like a fucking sword swallower one time. We really mixed it up.
And you had
it
a following with this.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really fun. By the end, we had like a lot of international talent or comics that would just be like, anytime they roll through LA, they would do our show. And we had the advantage of, it's Sunday at noon. What the fuck else are you doing?
Yeah.
Oh, you're playing this giant venue tonight?
No one's going to
church
in LA. Yeah.
Like, no, it's comedy church.
Yeah, yeah.
And we also did some themed stuff. So I remember we had Cat Day, where we would raise money for a local rescue. We had adoptable kittens in the lobby. And I booked only cat-themed comedy. So whether it was a sketch or stand-up or whatever, like, you just had to either reference a cat or be a cat or tell a story about a cat or whatever.
Yeah.
And those themed shows were always really fun weird.
Yeah.
I think one of the cat days we did, I did Phoebe Buffay, of course, Smelly Cat. I mean, you have to.
Yeah,
classic.
Of course.
And then a different one we did was Broadway Cats, like me and my co-host got all made up and did a whole.
So you did that for 4 years.
Uh-huh.
And what made you stop?
Was
the pandemic or before that?
It was right before. It was kind of one of those things where we had done it for a long time. We wanted to go out on a high note. She wanted to do other shows. I wanted to do other things. And so it was just one of those.
Yeah.
You know,
so it was great. It ran its course.
It was like,
this
lovely.
You came out, you left the way you wanted to leave it.
Yeah. I didn't want to be one of those things where it's like, oh, The Scramble, they're still doing that.
Yeah.
And instead, when I see people like, why did you stop doing that? And I love that. I want that. So, what was I going to say? Oh, stand up. So recently I had to have a foot surgery, which we can talk about in a second But when I used to do improv and all these different things, I was very physical with my comedy, you know? And now, even though I'm healed, I'm not supposed to do anything stupid physically about a year.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, what form of performance can I do where I'm not running around so much?
Yeah.
Stand up.
Yeah.
And I also thought, I'm tired of like improv teams and sketch teams, not because of the people, I love them, but the mechanism of having to organize all these rehearsals.
You need a space and
getting
get together,
the space and the director.
Late, and then they have a job, and then you have a job. Yeah.
And nobody ever takes it as seriously as I do. So then I end up being the Monica of the group, doing all the spreadsheets and getting all stressed out. And I just thought, like, this is an opportunity and I should take it. And I think also the other thing that was holding me back, because people for years have been like, oh, you do stand-up, right? You should do stand-up. Or when I was hosting The Scramble, people would ask me, hey, come do a few minutes of my show. And I would, like, I did a storytelling class, so I would just go tell a funny story.
Yeah.
Which I know it's not stand-up, but it's passable.
Yeah.
So I thought, you know what, like, fuck it. Like, I was so worried about what my family might think, because stand-up's a lot more personal, or worried about having a significant other, you know, as a woman, they're being a female comic, like, dudes, they're very judgy and weird.
Oh, you mean just the general audience?
The audience,
or you mean like
or
people
dating.
You were dating?
Yeah, that too. And so then I'm like at this point where I'm like, oh, like, I have a super supportive, chill partner, or I was, like, even before when I made this decision, I was single, and also, like, I'm fucking grown. I don't care what my family thinks.
Yeah.
You know, this is what I'm passionate about.
Yeah.
And so let's go try it. And I've been taking this class with Lisa Sunstedt called Pretty Funny Women.
Where is that?
It's in Burbank.
Okay.
And then they do a showcase at the end at Flappers.
At Laugh Factory. Oh, and I used to be at Laugh Factory. That's right.
Okay. So it's, yeah, I think, Flappers. Well, they also do shows at the store.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a few other places. So I just thought, this is great.
So you've been doing that for how long now?
I literally started the beginning of June.
So have you got, and do you get up on stage or just like in a little?
So you do the class, but then part of the class is that you need to be writing every day and going to open mics and stuff.
Oh wow, that's great.
So
I mean, once you do open mics, you're already like in the fucking, you're in the belly of the beast.
It's been, yeah.
Open mics, a lot of people, if you've never done an open mic, I almost think anyone in the world should do an open mic. It's just
experience
a great,
it once.
Because it is, I will tell you this too about open mics. You can take, I remember one time, Joe Coy, who's one of the biggest comics in the world right now. He, before he was like famous, mm-hmm. he went to do an open mic and he'd been murdered. I was opening for him. He was murdering all over. You know, he's a club comic, selling out clubs. And he was like, I'm doing an open mic in LA. And he fucking was like, never again.
Yeah.
Because it is, it's mostly comics who are there.
And it's impossible, not impossible, it's very hard to make other comics laugh out loud at an open mic.
At an open mic, yes. Particularly at an open mic, because they I think there's a weird, comics are a weird group, but there's a feeling of like, if I give you laughter, then that's going to steal my laughter or some weird shit.
But they're weirdly jealous.
Of course.
That you said something funny.
Yeah. Or they'll like, if you did say, I mean, I remember Dion Cole said this to me, and he's great, but he said to me, he goes, man, that joke, man, that joke, it pissed me off, man, because I love it. I want it. And I just, and I go, what was your reaction? He goes, I just nodded. So if you love someone's joke, you just go, fuck you for that joke. And the joke wasn't, I just turned creepy years old. You know you're getting creepy when you ask out a young girl and she's like, no thanks, mister. And that was the joke. I just nodded. I was like, oh yeah, fuck that guy. I like that joke. And that's how a comic that respects
that's how
you.
They laugh.
That's, it was like, they just not like, oh, fuck you for that. Or like, oh, it's so good. It's like when you're a chef, this is like, but you're not going to be like laughing.
No.
Because laughing is a completely different mechanism.
Yeah.
Than
appreciating. That's for the normies. That's for the civilians.
Yeah. And thank God for them.
So, yeah, that's kind of where I'm at. And I think, even though it's a newer form of comedy for me, I think that I don't know what the right way to say this is, but it's like all of the other experience that I've had on stage, doing theater, doing improv, sketch, hosting, like, that's not nothing. So I don't feel like I'm starting at hour zero of 10,000.
Of course.
I feel
not.
Like, I don't know where I'm at, but I'm definitely not at zero.
100%.
Right?
Yeah.
And there's a few girls in my class who, God bless them, literally never held a microphone before taking this class.
Of course. Or never been on stage. They were probably work corporate jobs or something else.
And I love that. I'm like, wow, so cool that you're going to come in here and do this. Or there's a few TV writers that are in there because of the strike. It's fun, something fun to do for them.
For sure.
So,
is there anything, and a lot of people go, oh, I'll just do it because I'm, you know, this or that. And then it becomes their thing. So do you have a joke that you go, oh, this is my first good joke. Like, I wrote a good joke. It's my first good joke. I feel proud about it. Because I feel like every comic, I think about that all the time. Like, what is a joke that I've...
Like, yeah, what was one of your first ones?
Well, you got to keep in mind, the first jokes that killed aren't necessarily jokes I'm proud of.
It doesn't matter.
The first jokes I did that killed were always really physical and goofy and fucking... oh my God. Sometimes in terms of a joke, the first joke I had that made me kind of like... Man, it's so hard to even remember because I look back and I think about it.
Because you've been doing it forever also.
Yeah, it's going to be 17 years now. So I think so much of the first few years were just so physical and just kind of most of my jokes are act out. So it's sort of like, what's your joke?
So you have to see it to really understand it. Like, it's not as much of the wordplay or the punchline. It's more so like the voices you're doing or the movements
you're
making. But
that's also changed too over the years. You know, you get a little older, you don't want to run around as much, you don't want to be so, you don't want to break dance on stage and shit. So, but I definitely, when you come, I feel like when I come up with anything that is like has like a mathematical structure
in
terms of its, you can number things or reverse things. I mean, an early joke I did, although it's a joke that I can't really do anymore because it just kind of reeks of sexism, is a joke where I say, I talk about...
I'm pulling out the joke, my little doc, so I can remember.
Talk about... It was my first bit that I liked, and this is probably 10 years old or 12 years old, but I talked about how like the hotter a woman is, the less she pays for stuff.
That is true.
You know, like a seven will pay for dinner like occasionally, and an eight won't even reach for a purse, a nine doesn't have a purse, a 10 has no idea what money looks like. She just knows there's a bartering system set up, she can travel Ibiza and blah, blah, blah.
Uh-huh.
A six is a giant purse with 4 credit cards, 2 debit cards, a laser pointer for a cat, and I just go on this whole thing, right? And that was like, but I have a lot of those jokes that have like sort of like a mathematical sort of like rhymes, couplets.
Like Shakespearean.
You know, even things, if you can get like a good rhyme that has like some integrity and some reversals in it, people love it, or like a voice, or any, it's almost uncanny how the same things always work. And sometimes it makes you want to like...
You know what's stupid that I did recently?
What?
At this New York open mic?
What? Oh, right. You were doing New York too. Yeah, that's
great.
Oh,
my God. Because I was like, I don't care if I'm on vacation. I got to get my reps in. I got to fucking do it.
Good for you. Where was it?
It was in Brooklyn. At this place called The Tiny Cupboard, which actually, shout out to the people who run it. Friendly, warm room. Really cute little club. And... It was like, I think the most kumbaya open mic I've been to, because they, at the beginning, the host said, his name's Adiel, he said, everyone gets 5 minutes, and then at the end of your set, optional, you can get 2 minutes of feedback from everyone.
Oh, if you want. Interesting. Wow.
Like to help you get better or to add some tags.
And are they like, by the way, make the feedback nice.
Yes. No, and he was like, don't be a dick. Like, feedback isn't you suck.
Yeah, like I didn't get it. What were you doing?
Feedback is, oh, that thing you did, here's a good tag for it, you know? So, what was I going to say? The beginning of the set, which I don't know if it's killed, but it threw people off enough that they laughed.
Yeah.
Bird calls. And then what is the other one I did? Oh, burp, burp. And I was like, hi. The whole room was like, like that was my intro.
So you just said bird calls.
No, I didn't say that. I just went up. The first thing out of my mouth was.
Like, are these actual bird calls too, by the way?
Oh, this is a pigeon.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And then there are a bunch of peacocks near my house that have been driving me fucking insane. Uh-huh. And they, like, their mating call sounds like someone squawking like they're being murdered. It's like. And there's hundreds of them doing this. Anyway, that doesn't count as a joke. But
so you did the bird call. It's just kind of like this interesting element in the room.
It's weird and fun.
Yeah.
But I think that, like, one that I said that definitely got a big laugh, which I guess I can throw out to you, was, so in case you couldn't tell by now, I'm Jewish, which means, you know, like every other Jewish person, I have anxiety, I have seasonal allergies, and... For some reason, everyone likes to blame their problems on me. You know, whenever there's a virus or a war or anything, they say that we've got a Jewish space laser and we're causing all the problems. And I just wish that I had that level of influence.
Yeah.
And that got a little, you know, something.
Yeah.
And then going on that whole thing. And I have a whole bit about how people have told me multiple times that I'd be a good cult leader.
Is it true?
It's true. Isn't that weird? Just like, I guess because I'm charismatic, I know about psychology, I have an extensive collection of headbands. I don't know.
Yeah.
So I'm figuring stuff out. I'm also like, I have a lot of weird pet peeves, you know, and those are always fun to explore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I feel like whenever you go to a hotel, they just never have enough towels. You notice that?
Yeah.
It's like they only give you one towel and it's scratchy and it like barely covers your crotch.
Yeah.
I feel like there should be 2 bath towels for every man, woman, child. Also like a few small face towels for my 8-step Korean skincare routine. And then also like, don't get me started on the cum towels. We need them. I need them in my life.
Yeah,
but I'm developing it. And I'm also figuring out like, there's a little bit of an identity crisis I'm having because I'm like, oh, what is my persona? on stage? What's my point of view? Do I even need to know that?
I don't think so.
Right.
My feeling is you'll find that people, and you know, it also depends like what you mean by that. Because someone like Theo Von, you know, he definitely found his persona, but like minimum 10 years into his stand-up career, he was just like, he became the guy with the mullet. Before that, he was a good looking preppy guy on Road Rules. So, but it took a long time for him galvanizing his audience, his character, to kind of like hone into this thing that everyone like. Now, you don't have to do that either. You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
Theo now has to have a mullet for the rest of his life, or he can't work.
That's too much commitment.
So you don't necessarily need to have a character, but at the same time, I think the best thing to do is just sort of, obviously the first thing is to be funny. Second thing is to be as vulnerable as possible if you can, but that takes a long time to be really vulnerable. I mean, to talk about the stuff, because obviously your mental health podcast is vulnerable, right?
And I've been like very publicly vulnerable on like a big level with that. So I'm hoping to like, once I get better at just even the joke telling of it all, to be able to insert more of that, jokes about anxiety, panic attacks, PTSD, whatever, you know?
Yeah. People really, and I'm now 17 years in this year, and I'm finding out, and I'm always amazed by things like, as I'm talking about, you know, my daughter, my 2-year-old daughter, and I'm talking about like the experience of finding out and just, even just talking about that, people like right away, they end up laughing at things that in my mind aren't funny. So I'm up there saying things that I don't think are funny, because what's funny to me is like really the most uncomfortable thing in the, like if it doesn't make me cringe, it's not funny to me.
Sure.
It's just an observation that's cute.
Mm-hmm.
So comics that say shit, they go, ooh, or comics who, like someone like Jason Rouse, who just is just like one of the most uncomfortable, like I will cry laughing watching him, because of whatever my fucking emotional damage is that needs to be challenged like that in order to fucking feel.
Yeah.
But, and also for me, but I've also realized like my level of what I need to laugh when I find humorous.
You like the uncomfortable.
Is not what the majority of the audience wants. So then my only option to give them what they want and not feel compromised is to really try to share and be vulnerable and breathe into the uncomfortability of being a man at my early to late 40s who has a 2-year-old child from a failed COVID relationship, you know, and people right away, they go, you know, they have a lot they can relate to.
It's so relatable.
Yeah.
And it's good because you're just opening the door instead of just saying, oh, I'm just a comic who's here to entertain you.
Yes.
Laugh at me.
And then when I get a little bit edgier and meaner in my material, I don't think I'm mean, but I've been accused of being mean. When I get a little bit edgier, then you always have the fail safe of like, guys, remember, I'm single. I live in a studio apartment by myself.
Dad.
I'm a dad. Like, you know, like, I'm going to die alone. So you feel happy in that.
Oh, no.
Feel happy in feeling that
Phil,
way.
You know, you're not going to die alone.
Why not?
Okay. Well, I mean, that's what you want.
I told my dad that. And he's like, sounds peaceful.
Okay. I mean, if that's what you're choosing, but I just think never say never.
You never know. Well, I'm looking forward to your new journey in stand-up comedy. Maybe we'll do a show down the road and you'll become famous and then I can open for you.
Yes.
But yeah, anyway, I can
We'll call it Doll and Dawes. Dawes and Doll.
I love it. Any way I can help you, obviously, you know, you can always call me. It's good to be reconnected with you again.
Yes.
Kayla.
Yes. You know, lovely, I feel like dad life is really suiting you.
Why?
There's a softness to you and a like nurturing to you that I haven't seen before.
What the fuck are you talking about, bitch?
No, I'm just saying.
Really?
It's nice. Yeah.
No, I feel like I've always been soft and nurturing.
Right. No, that was there. But I feel like there was a little bit of a like tough front or something. I don't know.
Well, I do think, and I was talking to Tommy earlier about this, I do think that when you are a dad and like a new dad in particular, because you know my first daughter, I didn't even
you
meet her
involved?
Until I met her when she was around my current daughter's age, you know.
Yeah, no, I remember because I went out with you to Malibu one time when you were gonna go meet her.
Oh, and then she couldn't meet.
I don't
her
remember
something.
What happened.
Yeah, it was weird. I had to play all sorts of games with her mom. Like that. It was very odd. Anyway, so this is and she's great. I'm still like, you know, I'm still in touch with her and still sending her money. God damn it. But anyway,
good dad.
You gotta do it. Dad, I can't eat this week. All right. Anyway, you kind of realize that these you know, you have these lives in your hands, and you look at your own life when you were a child, and you think about, I personally believe that the world has an opportunity to be much better.
Yes.
By bringing in people who are, you know, they get to benefit from all the wisdom of all the failures of past generations. Because if you think about most generations of people, like, they had a dad who beat the fuck out of them. Then the next dad beat the fuck out of them less.
Mm-hmm.
And last dad just spanked them here and there. And the next dad gave him time out. And I just feel like you hear, like, my mom's story versus my grandma's story, just the amount of trauma that people just have endured generationally. Like, it doesn't have to be that
way.
No,
of course. That's something I'm really passionate about. And also, like, just breaking those chains of intergenerational trauma.
100%.
And that's something that you can choose to take on if you actually can see the patterns within your own family or within the society you're living in. You want to be different, then go for it.
Because we're at the generation now where you recognize that you have suffered trauma.
Yes.
And that it's something that if you're not paying attention to it, you can pass on to your child.
Yeah, or even just like,
as opposed to before, you just pass it on because this was just what you did.
Well, even if you're not having kids, just like, you can be like, because you're coming out of this traumatized state, you're being angry or controlling or all these other behaviors towards your friends, your coworkers, your family. Like, we don't have to revisit this shit upon other people. Let's work it out. So
for sure.
Absolutely. And I appreciate having me on. I got to have you on my podcast.
Oh, for sure.
You know, so that we can
talk about mental health. Of course.
Yes.
All sorts of things I can talk about.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you for having me. And
thank you, Kayla. Great to see you again. And check where can people find you?
So if people want to find me, I am on all the socials at Kayla Dolle, KeiladoLle. Or if you want to see the podcast, I have video and audio now.
Mm-hmm.
Crying Behind Sunglasses. It's on all the, you know, Spotify and,
she's a looker.
Apple Podcasts.
So, you know.
Thank you. A looker, he says. I'll take it.
I'm old fashioned. All right, guys. Thanks for listening. Have a good one. Bye-bye.